I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I am so happy to welcome to The Stacks, Kaveh Akbar. Kaveh is a writer, poet, and educator, and his new book, Martyr, is also his debut novel. It's about a young Iranian man who is grappling with his family history, his own addiction, and his desire to have his life and death matter. I read and absolutely loved this novel, and I am so thrilled I get to talk with Kaveh today about his impulse to proselytize art in all of his work, how he researched for the book, and how writing a book of prose compared to his writing of poetry. There are no spoilers in today's episode. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for January is Erasure by Percival Everett, and we will be discussing that book with Zach Stafford on Wednesday, January 31st. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you love this show and you want more of it, like access to the best bookish community on earth, okay, I might be biased, but it's true, you've got to join The Stacks Pack at patreon.com/thestacks. For just $5 a month, you get our fantastic reading tracker, which is only available until January 31st. You get access to our year-long reading challenge, bonus episodes, entry into the Stacks Pack, amazing Discord, and you can come to our monthly virtual book club meetups. It's a great space to let your reading life flourish alongside other readers and lovers of this show. Plus, and this might be me burying the lead, but by joining the Stacks Pack, you make it possible for me to make this show every single week. So please head to patreon.com/thestacks and join us. Shout out to our newest members of the Stacks Pack, Jessica Gwynn, Amy, Allison Greenhouse, Christiana Rodriguez, Adrian Davenport, Lauren Rhodes, Lamont Jones, and Lydia LP. Thank you all so much for joining the Stacks Pack, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. Okay, now it's time for my conversation with Kaveh Akbar. All right, everybody. 2024, new year. Same me, except for I already found a novel that I love this year, which is incredible and unbelievable. I am joined today by Kaveh Akbar. He is a poet. He is also the author of his debut novel. It's called Martyr, with an exclamation point, which we will talk about. Kaveh, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It's a sincere honor to be here.
I'm so happy to be here. We have to shout out Clint Smith, because he's the reason I know about your book. When he was on the show, yeah. We recorded in March, but the episodes aired in April, and he just casually mentioned, I'm reading this book that's really great. You have to keep an eye out for it. I immediately started my 2024 book I'm excited about list with one book on it because it was very early to be starting the list, but you know, Clint says it. And so I'm really excited to be here with you now because I feel like I've been like waiting for this thing and Clint was right. It's good, which I hate to say. I hate Clint. I hate for Clint to be right because he's already like handsome and has a great voice and he's a great writer. Yeah. And then he like also is right.
And was a D1 athlete too.
Was a D1 athlete. And he knows Steph Curry. It's just all the things. Anyways,
it's really obnoxious. He's the worst person to be friends with because he's better at everything. He's better at his hobbies than you are at your main thing.
Yeah, I get that sense about him, but he's at least like kind of like soft spoken about it. He's not like super in your face, you know, like he's not like an asshole about it.
No, he's the best. He is one of the great sort of stewards of my learning how to write a prose book.
I love that.
He had my back at every step of the way.
I love that. Okay, so now we've done our Clint Smith, obligatory Clint Smith praise. Now we get to talk about you. 30 seconds or so, tell folks about Martyr.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm going to use some of my 30 seconds to just say how much I love the show and how stoked I am to be here. What a surreal thing. Martyr is the story of a young man named Cyrus Shams, who is an Iranian immigrant to America. He's orphaned. He's newly in recovery. And he doesn't feel particularly attached to being alive. And he is kind of obsessed with this idea that the thing that he can offer the world is a meaningful death. And he's trying to figure out how to make a meaningful death count. And he hears about this artist who's performing her own dying in the Brooklyn Museum in New York. And so he goes to interview this artist for this project that he's doing around secular martyrdom. And in the course of this journey and these conversations, his whole life begins to flip upside down and there are, you know, and things get zany from there.
Things happen. I should say to everyone, you can listen to this episode. We are not going to spoil. If at any point we spoil, we will make sure we cut it out and you do not hear a single spoiler because you just got to read the book. Okay, I want to start here with the book. Where did you get this idea for this book? We're recording this before the book has come out. And usually when I interview someone, sometimes like I get a chance to hear them talk about the book or talk about the work, but I really haven't heard you talk about it yet, which is exciting for me, but also means that like I'm nervous that everything I ask you, everyone else is going to ask you. So I am going to try to ask you some tricky questions. But for now, I just sort of want to know where this, where like Cyrus came from in this story and like your interest in martyrs.
Yeah, well, I should say too, I haven't really spoken about the book much. You know, we're still a few weeks away from the 23rd. I don't know what that math is, but we're still a ways away from the actual publication of this book. And so, talking with you is one of the first real conversations with a reader who's not married to me, or you know, like a dear friend of mine who I've known forever. So the idea for this book, it actually started with the idea of the artist's performance of her own dying. You know, there's a famous performance by the performance artist Marina Abramović called The Artist is Present, where she sits in the gallery and people come and sit across from her for a minute and she just makes sustained eye contact with them. And I always thought it would be fascinating for someone with a terminal illness to do a similar performance of their own dying in the space of an art museum, in a culture where we are so insulated from death and, you know, images of the dead. And even when we encounter the dead, they're, you know, fully made up and, you know, they're in their best gowns or their best suits or whatever, you know. And so to actually encounter the dying, I always thought that was an interesting idea. And one of the beautiful brilliance of fiction is that it allows you to play out a thought experiment, It allows you to sort of enact such an idea without actually having to be literally dying of terminal breast cancer myself, And so it began with that. And I actually had this sort of, I mean, I've written a trillion drafts of this book and they all start, I handwrite everything. And so the earliest drafts were very sort of, is it Tuesdays with Maury? Is that the book where it's like you're like sat across from the dying person and there is this sort of oracular, brilliant dying person.
Mitch Albom.
Yeah. And but I realized that there was no real sort of narrative pulse there. You know, it was just sort of a repository for this person to be saying wise, gnomic, oracular things. And so in figuring out a way to create a narrative superstructure around that art object, you know, Cyrus, who is now really the protagonist of the book, the center of the book, came into clarity and became the vehicle.
Wow. Okay, you said something that we have to go back to. You write everything by hand?
I do, I do. I have thousands of pages of notebooks and notepads and just scrawled. And I'm super unorganized about it too.
Oh,
so like,
God.
I'll be traveling and I'll be writing on a hotel notepad and I'll be writing on the backs of menus and these and this and that. And then I'll just, you know, periodically I'll type it up into the computer. But the typing it up into the computer is such an important revision stage for me. Because, you know, it with my hand and my, you know, it's easy to just make stuff on a page. There's literal sort of kinetic propulsivity. There's literal momentum. Right, whereas on the screen, you know, you're trying to fine tune everything as you write it. And it makes everything, you know, you're writing in Garamond maybe already. And it looks so sharp and it looks so pretty that it sort of disguises half thoughts as thoughts. So yeah, for me, I have to start everything by hand.
This is a thing I've heard other authors talk about the font mattering to them. And it is, for me, a reader, and a person who sometimes has to write but truly does not like writing and does not feel precious about it. I'm just like, how quickly can I turn this in? I have never once considered font. Like,
really?
It is so interesting to think that, like, I mean, sometimes there'll be a book where, like, one letter is, like, weird. And I'm like, that's such a weird, like, why is the G so loopy, you know? But, like, I have never read a sentence and even, or, like, written a sentence and ever thought, like, let me change this to Times New Roman and see if it, like, feels different. Or, like, oh, okay, yeah. I'm gonna, like, unless it's Comic Sans, you know?
Yeah.
Like, unless it's just,
well,
like,
goofy. I mean, but that's the zenith of the thought, though, right?
I guess.
Like, imagine switching from Comic Sans to Helvetica or something very stately, Garamond, right? Like, that's the zenith of the same thing. And I should also say that I started out in poetry. I mean, my whole life I've spent calling myself a poet. So I think a lot about I'm very sensitive to the field of the page, right?
Yeah.
The way that the poem as visual object works. You know, just visually entering my, you know, and so a page of, you know, really, really pretty looking prose, you know, the way that Garamond makes anything look, you know, make Lorna.
I don't even know which font that is. I'm going to change
Garamond. Oh, I'm sorry. It's like a Times New Roman. I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to look it up and see how it looks on my page.
It's a sort of serifed Times New. You'll recognize it when you see it. But
oh, yes, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Garamond. I do feel different
about
myself.
So you can see how saying anything in Garamond will kind of give it this stately veneer.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, I'm more of an aerial girl myself. That's what
I like aerial. I like to compose in Calibri or aerial just because they feel like neutral. You know what I mean? Like it feels like I'm just seeing, or I like to do first drafts or second drafts or whatever. You know, like the drafts where I'm still very new to the prose and it's very molten, I like to do in aerial or Calibri. Yeah.
Since we're talking about how you write, we should just do this section of the episode now at the very beginning.
Sure.
Then we'll go back to the book.
Sure.
When you're writing on paper and you're not just like out at a hotel or like somewhere doing on scraps, like if you're sitting down to write, is it a notepad? My sister-in-law is a professor. She works on her dissertation. Sometimes she gets giant poster boards and writes on like,
that's cool.
She's very small. And so she'll like get on top of the poster board and like crouch down like on the ground and like write on it.
I love that though.
Yeah. It's, I'm like, so she just does it sometimes if she feels stuck. She'll like get a big piece of paper, like a big piece of butcher paper or something. So I'm wondering, are you using lined paper? Is it in a journal? Is it a notepad? I'm a yellow legal girly myself.
I love a yellow legal pad.
Okay, that's my place.
Yeah. I love a yellow legal pad. That's kind of my platonic ideal writing surface. But I will say I often default to ye olde notebook because
like a moleskin moment or like a composition.
Yeah, I don't need to be so precious as a mole, you know, any old, you know,
any
like
notebook.
You get a lot of notebooks traveling around to universities and stuff like this. And so any old, you know, I actually like the ones with the dots, you know, instead of the lines, you know, that
like grids.
Like the dot grids. Yeah, I like those.
I like those too.
But yeah, I like a yellow legal pad just because, again, it feels so low stakes. Like it feels almost like the paper of a rough draft. You know what I mean? Like it's like you just flip and it's so easy to tear stuff out too, right? The problem is that I often, you know, just toss it back in my backpack or whatever, and then the pages will tear out and get all out of order. And sometimes I'll lose a page or lose a couple pages, and then I'll be heartbroken.
That's
the worst. But a lot of Martyr was written on yellow legal pads. I have a whole
and the book is yellow now, so that
and the book is yellow. It persisted. Yeah, they intuited that through the language.
Do you snack or beverage while you write? And when do you write?
Yeah, I have an IV drip of coffee going at any given moment.
And how do you take your coffee?
Well, great question. I love this podcast. This is going great. I don't know if if the listeners are pretty. Yeah,
they're gonna love this. They always love when we get into the weeds. I'm like, we're gonna talk about this, and then all of a sudden I get all these messages about how weird shit got. Usually we get weird later, but I'm vibing.
Sure. No, this is perfect. This is perfect. Are you a coffee? Is that what you're drinking?
I'm a tea girly. I take my black tea with milk and sugar.
Milk and sugar. Oh, yeah, very British. Yeah,
both.
Yeah
and a
yeah,
lot of yeah. both. Half and half, well, honestly. Let's not milk.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. So I sort of trained myself to take my coffee black so that in the absence of additives, I would still enjoy it, you know? But when I'm feeling fancy, I do like a little bit of like oat milk or whatever's around, you know, oat milk or whatever's in the house just to sort of set it off and feel nice about myself.
Yeah. Any snacks?
I'm not a big snacker. I'm not a big...
All right, you're friends with Clint. I should have fucking known. You people don't eat. The Clint community does not eat.
I tend to write in the mornings, and the food tends to be the demarcator of when I'm done writing and can begin like answering emails or, you know, being the sort of person who manages a life that I get to be an artist in, you know?
Because you're a professor also, right?
Yeah. Right,
of
right.
Creative I teach at writing.
The
university.
Yeah, I teach at the University of Iowa, and so usually I spend my mornings into the early afternoon on whatever creative thing I'm working on, and then I shift around noon or one or two into answering emails, working on class stuff, etc.
Can I ask a question? I've always been really curious about people who teach writing as they write a book.
Yeah.
Do your students and their work ever get in your way?
Yeah. So no, they don't. I mean, not in the nicest way.
If your students are listening, I don't want you to feel like you have to defend their work.
No. I mean, my answer is that. So, like, when I was writing Martyr, I was on this sort of force feed narrative diet. So I was reading two novels a week and watching a movie a day, just to like just dump narrative into myself, right? And so I was just broadly kleptomaniacally cribbing everybody. You know what I mean? That, you know, the student's work would indelibly inflect my thinking, but it wouldn't be so, there was never a moment where I was like, ooh, this line, is so, you know. Also, I'm teaching here at Iowa. I've only been here at Iowa for a year and a half, and I've taught a lot of undergraduate courses, right? And I've been lucky that I've been able to teach mostly literature undergraduate courses. So I've been teaching, you know, poetry of antiquity and you know, thinking about Mesopotamian and Mesoamerican and Sub-Saharan African poetries and thinking about. And so the texts that I'm teaching tend to inflect the registers of my language more than the students' responses to them.
It's interesting to hear that you were like consuming a lot of narrative and stuff as you were writing this, because one of the things that I really loved about the book, and one of the things that really stuck out to me, is how many references to other art pieces there are. Like there's a choral opera that's referenced that I was reading the book in the bathtub, because that is my favorite place to read. And I had to reach out of the tub and like get my phone and play Allegri's Misery.
Yeah.
And I've been listening to it daily now for like the last 3 days since that section through to today. So I think, 3 days. And there's so many things that I like was looking up as I was reading, or like trying to find pictures of, or like, and I had the sense of like, oh, the author here is like very interested in art broadly, and like the stories behind art, which I thought was really interesting because it's really not about the song. I mean, it is the scene that is like so good. it is about the song, but it's really about the story behind the song. And so I guess the question here, and this is sort of a big question about the book, is like, how are you thinking about art ownership or like art? Who is the art about? Is it about the artist or is it about the art consumer or both or neither? It's such a big question.
No. I love it. First of all, I love that you're listening to Allegri's Misery.
Also, did you know that Allegri means like cheerful?
Cheerful's misery.
Yes. Yeah. And at first, when I pulled up the song on Spotify, it just said Allegri and then like colon misery. And I was like, is this supposed to be like, I thought that was the title of the song. Like I don't listen to a lot of classical music, so I didn't realize that like the artist is in the title. And then I looked it up and I was like, oh, that's the guy's name. But that's so interesting because like, obviously like misery is like sad and Allegri in Italian means cheerful. And I only know that because in ballet you do a petit allegro, which is like a fast dance, fast feet kind of thing.
Yeah. Anyways, sorry, I've always been fascinated by that piece and the story behind it, which is, you know,
well, we'll save it. You have to read the book.
Yeah, we'll save it.
Because it's so good. Sorry, the way it comes up in the book is so good. I don't want anybody to know anything.
It's funny because it's a true historical story. But it is a little spoiler adjacent.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I it has always felt incumbent on me to proselytize the art that I love when I love it. You know what I mean? In the same way that like, if you have a Kit Kat and you're with three friends, you're not going to eat the entire Kit Kat bar by yourself. You know what I'm saying?
We're like, different. It's like... We're different. You know? I'm not sharing that Kit Kat.
Well, okay. I would... there's also this thing in Persian culture called Taraf, which is like this elaborate etiquette dance where you come over to my house and I say... Tracy, do you want some tea? And you say, no, I couldn't. And I say, no, please. So I pour you a cup of tea. And then I bring out a bowl of fruit and I say, hey, Tracy, do you want some, you know, you want an apple? And you're like, no, I couldn't, you know? And I'm like, yes, you know? And like, the old joke is that two Iranian men can never get on an elevator because they'll keep saying, no, after you. Yeah, put it in the book. Yeah, after you. And then, and then the elevator doors will just open and close.
Right.
But I think that there's some of that in the way that I love art too, is like, I love it. The things that I like, I really become obsessive about and really, really love. And then immediately it becomes urgent that I, you know, push that outwards and that I, you know, get every, because it adds so much value and texture and meaning and joy to my life that I want the people that I love to be the beneficiaries of that. But it can be suffocating, right? And it can be exhausting. You know, my spouse has dealt with me for, you know, a decade now of like being like, you're going to love this movie. And then just like hawkishly watching them as they watch it, which is the most obnoxious thing.
I can relate to this. This is this is how this podcast started.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. We have these important simpaticos. Yeah. We're of the same tribe.
Yeah.
And so inevitably that's going to come into the art that I make too. I'm never not thinking about Allegri's Misery, just as I'm never not thinking about EPMD Strictly Business, just as I'm never not thinking about any of the other art pieces discussed in the book, right? Mm-hmm. Just as I'm never, you know, and so Bruegel's Fall of Icarus plays prominently late in the book, right? Bruegel's Landscape of the Fall of Icarus. And so getting to make characters nerd out about this stuff in ways that feel germane to the narrative is thrilling, right? Again, it's you get to just have, and instead of having to exhaustively write, you know, a 10,000 word essay for Art Forum about why I feel so moved by this piece of art or whatever, I can just think 500 excited words about it without exhaustively sort of researching every provenance, right? And just be a more authentic representation of how that effusion actually feels in my own brain. So fiction is a delicious sandbox. it's a wonderful place to play in that specific way.
Did you like writing a narrative? I mean, you're a poet, and I know another poet who's working on his first novel, and he's saying like that it's exciting, but also it's hard because it's really different.
It's incredibly hard. I mean, that's why I was on this narrative diet, right? Because I didn't want to presume, you know, the hubris of just saying, because I've studied poetry my whole life, I would immediately know how to write a novel. And in fact, I think poems are closer to dance or statuary than they are to narrative fiction, at least lyric poetry. And I think that in terms of the crossover, for me anyways, there was so much just architectonically that I had to learn. You know, like I knew how to say wise seeming things, you know, or have like characters say wise seeming things to each other, but explaining how they move through doorways and how they got on a plane to the city where they would have this conversation, or why they were sat at a table and what the table looked like. And, you know, like these sorts of things are the crisis of narrative. And I had there was nothing in my education that ever trained me to do any of that in a way that felt organic and not, and oh, by the way, he got the money because blah, 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 and that's how he bought the plane ticket. And then he got, you know what I mean? Like to actually seamlessly blended in with the narrative is not something that came naturally to me at all. So, you know, that's how I could just watch any old movie on Netflix. I mean, it could be Pineapple Express or whatever. And I was still learning like how you get characters through the beats of a narrative, how you get people through doorways and into conversations and stuff like, and what they're doing with their hands while they talk, etc.
So I follow you on Instagram. Yeah, I'm snooping. I'm snooping as one does. And I also love the acknowledgments of the book. And there is a person who is the first person you thank, which is Tommy Orange, author of There, There, and the forthcoming The Wandering Stars.
Yeah, you should have him on. The Wandering Stars
is
so good.
We're both from Oakland. I've been trying to get him to want to be friends with me forever.
It's such a natural thing.
It's going to happen. This is my 100%. Year. When I started the show, the year I started the show, 2018, is when There, There came out. And so I didn't really have a lot of people on the show because people were like, who the fuck is that girl? But now, 5 years later, 6 years later, I'm like, Tommy Orange, it's
300 episodes in.
I think he went to middle school with my brother.
No way.
Yeah, my brother was like, I think I know that guy. Anyways, I'm sort of curious about that relationship. I saw on your Instagram that you guys met once and then you met again recently for the first time. But you guys like have a daily writing group or something. You're like in constant contact. I know you share an editor. I didn't figure that out.
Yeah.
What is that relationship like? Like, I just am such a fan of his. And and there are things in your book that I was like, oh, even before I saw that, I was like, oh, this does have Tommy Orange vibes because there's like all these different characters and they all have their different perspectives. And I knew that your book was published by Knomp. So I knew that like there was a chance, you know, your novel feels very Knomp. I don't know what that means, but like feel Knomp to me. Praise. I couldn't articulate what that means, but like as I was reading it, I was like, this book is at the exact right place that it should be at. But I'm just curious about how you and Tommy work together and like what that relationship looks like.
Yeah. So he calls it the band. We're bandmates. Oh. And every Friday we do band practice where we swap pages we just swap pages, a couple of days ago, but, we've sent each other Friday pages for years, I think since 2018.
Wow.
And that is how these novels came to be. He wrote Wandering Stars and I wrote Martyr. Over the course of these Friday pages, I was teaching at Purdue University at the time. And in 2018, he came as a visiting writer and, he was actually brought by someone else. I didn't bring him. And I was like in charge of driving him around.
Oh,
and as soon as he saw me, he ran up to me. Like he was like surrounded by, you know, a throng. By this point, like there had kind of hit and so he was surrounded by like a throng of acolytes. But as soon as he saw me, he literally like bounded down the sidewalk towards me. And he had a copy of my very first chapbook, not even my first book, but like my first chapbook of poems. And he was like, you're one of my favorite poets, you know, and I'm not sharing this to like gas myself, but it just like immediate, so cool. You know, like what
just
could
like
be
a connection.
More, I know, like what could be more endearing, you know, like what could be more. And I, you know, and I'm like, you're Tommy Orange,
Tommy Orange.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah. And so we were driving around and at some point he told me that while I was driving him, he told me that he had just gotten to sit in on a Simpsons table read in California, like the actors doing a table read of a new episode. Yeah. And I love, like the Simpsons is like a low, I mean, there's
a Lisa Simpson
in the book.
Is in the
book. Yeah. There's a Lisa Simpson chapter in the book. And the Simpsons is like a huge, huge thing for me. And just unconsciously under my breath, I was like, oh, fuck you. Like, I was just like I was like, just like in that way that, you know, it wasn't like animosity, but it was just like, I was so jealous.
Yeah.
Yet that I couldn't be the good sort of ambassador of the university. And he thought that was the funniest thing. And he like lost his mind laughing. And then we started talking like real people. And then, yeah, he wrote a poem that night and sent it to me. And so I wrote a poem once I got his poem and sent it to him. And then he was like, all right, when are we doing the next one? You know? Yeah. And so we started writing poems back and forth. And then we started writing pages. And then we started writing characters. And so, yeah, he wrote Wandering Stars, which is extraordinary, just absolutely, utterly everything you want. It's like a prequel and a sequel to There, There. And it's also just this totally new thing. It's if you love There, There, this is it does everything. I mean, I can't sing its praises enough. But yeah, so he's all over this book. Every page of this book, Tommy has read a dozen times in a dozen different forms, you know, in a dozen different drafts. You know, he's probably read, you know, this book could have been, you know, 1,500 pages if I wanted it to be, if I just put everything that I'd written into
it. Thank God it's not.
I know.
Because we wouldn't be having this conversation.
I know. I mean, well, that's part of the game, right? Part of the game is figuring out how to tell a story in a way that the reader will actually take in. You know, like Richard Pryor said, he wanted to get you laughing so that your mouth would be open so he could pour the poison down, right? And I think that, like, that understanding of delighting the reader, you know, like, actually, like, recognizing that the opportunity cost of them reading a book that takes 10 hours or whatever to read is like, you could learn how to order, you could learn enough French to like order in a restaurant off Duolingo in 10 hours. You know what I mean? Like you could watch a season of any, you know, the opportunity cost of reading a 10-hour novel is so great that like, I'm very, very cognizant of that at every moment, you know? And so I wanted it to be as compact and irreducible as possible, which doesn't mean there's not like flights of imagination you know, fun and play, but I wanted it all to feel necessary. Right.
Yeah.
And so there is so much cut from it. But I say this to say Tommy has read, you know,
all that other stuff.
Yeah. Tommy has read like, you know, five martyrs back to back to back, you know?
Well, I will say how I have been describing this book to people is like, this is one of the most enjoyable reading experiences that I've had. Like I've just I really enjoyed, I love your sentences and I love Cyrus. And like, it's like sad and dark, which I love, but it's enjoyably sad and dark. And it's also like funny and like, kind of like got a little attitude, not like a bad attitude, but like a little bit of an attitude.
Yeah.
And since you said this, I'm just curious now, what is not in the book that you wish could still be in the book?
Oh, I mean, there's so much. None of it that I wish could still be in the book, because I think that the book really is like the correct reduced package, right? But there are so many more dreams that aren't in the book, right? There are so many more dream sequences.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say this. Cyrus, the main character, he has the way he helps himself like go to sleep is by like taking characters or people in his life and like creating scenes for them as he's like nodding off, and they sort of become these dreams that he's like maybe controlling, but also just like observing. So there's one between Lisa Simpson and his mother who has died. There's one between his imaginary brother and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And they're these sort of like weird little interlude type things. So there is an interlude, so it's not that, but it's like these like dream.
There's also an interlude.
These like dream sequences that are also maybe like semi-conscious. It's like that space where you wake up early and then you can't quite fall back asleep, but you start thinking about like your to-do list, but then all of a sudden you're like at school and then you're like, wait, but I have to walk the dot. It's like that weird space. Yeah. That's what we're talking about, the dreams.
Yeah.
So there's more of those.
Yeah. So there are these weird little scenes that are, and it's a way of getting to know the characters, right? They were for me early on, just a way, it was almost like an exercise, you know, so that I could get to know who my, you know, some people make like a character bio sheet. And Cyrus Shams is 6'1". You know, he's got brown hair, whatever, you know? And I sort of did these little dream sequences. So there are those. I mean, there are Gabe, the Cyrus's sponsor in the book.
Oh, yeah.
There are scenes with him that ultimately were cut from the book, scenes with him and Z actually, and his son, and Gabe's son, like at a diner. I make little zines. It's nice to like have a creative practice that's not attached to how I buy my dog's food.
Right.
And so I one of the things that I do is like paint and make little zines and stuff. And I did put, there's like a diner scene with them, and I put that into the zine. I'll make sure to send you one too.
Oh, cool.
You know, just little sort of riffs and ideas, and there's more of you know, sort of flashbacks to Iran, and there's an uncle in the book, and there's more uncle.
Oh my God, the uncle is my favorite part of the whole book.
Yeah, he's I dream about him, which is maybe not a very sexy thing for an author to say about a character.
Well, it's also like a
very
dark dream.
Yeah. Well, that's the funny, you know, I speaking of our friend Clint, you read Ross Gay with him, right? And I think that what your conversation got so right, and what a lot of people miss about his work is that he is so brilliant. People are like, oh, he's such a joyful poet. He's such a delightful poet, or a poet of gratitude, but it's always gratitude made wise by having known grief.
Yeah,
right?
There's always like grief deeply.
Yeah, there's always like the sick father in the room, or the sick world in the room. Right. While there is, you know, which makes the grief. I'm getting goosebumps talking about this because his work means so much to me. But and that is the if the book is. I mean, the book is obviously about serious themes. It's about addiction and wanting to kill yourself and wanting to make meaning out of a life and death and heritage and art. But one can be consumed by all of those things and still enjoy making out with their boyfriend. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. One can be consumed by all of those things and still enjoy a movie or a concert, you know?
Right.
And I wanted that sort of braided essence to be the case throughout the book. And so, hearing you say that, it was enjoyable to read. I mean, that's everything to me. That no joke. That's the most gratifying thing in the world to hear.
Oh, yay. Well, it was. Okay, wait, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. and their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. I have some more questions about the actual book itself. And is the uncle's job in the military, is that real? Or did you make that up?
So the uncle's job in the military in the Iran-Iraq War was, in the book, his job is to ride around the fields after the battles have been fought, right? He goes out at night wearing a big cloak with a flashlight under his face on top of a horse. And his job is to just ride around, and these dying men who have just given their lives in this battle, who aren't quite dead yet, will see this hooded rider with an illuminated face holding a sword. He also has a sword, and believe him to be the angel of death, or, you know, in some ways he's there to validate their belief, you know, that they have died for a righteous cause.
And
right?
So that they won't kill themselves, because if they kill themselves, they will not get to go to the after. Great hereafter.
Right, because in lots of Islamic theology, or in lots of Islamic beliefs, if you kill yourself, even if you're already dying, even if you're dying on a battlefield, you don't get to go to heaven, right? And so he's there to sort of bolster their resolve to die nobly without accelerating. And so, you know, it's the whole book at large is thinking about Cyrus wanting to kill himself, right? And so there's this sort of mirroring. With regards to that job being reality, my father was in the Iranian army, as were all of his brothers, and I was working on this book early stages, as you can imagine, and I knew about the, so they would give the infantry, the grunts, keys to wear around their necks that were like, they would call them keys to heaven, right? Oh. The idea being that these infantry were so sort of expendable, mm-hmm. right? But they should be thinking of
They were definitely going to die, so you need this key.
100,000%. Yeah. It was the first war since World War I to use human wave attacks. In other words, like instead of like clearing a minefield, you know, slowly and deliberately of each mine, you just mm-hmm. threw out like a wave of men to clear the field and then throw out the right. second wave, you know. And so they would go into battle wearing these keys around their necks as you know, keys to heaven. And I was writing about that, and I asked my dad the word for, because they had a name, and I asked my dad what those keys were called. And as he was telling me, he also told me then that each battalion had one of these soldiers, right?
So it was real. Well, you embellished it, but this idea is...
Yeah, I mean, again, like, in my dad's consciousness, and, you know, my relationship to my dad is complicated, okay. and, you know, like, all of our relationships...
We don't have parents, to do that.
No. I'm just saying, like, in my dad's consciousness, you know, what he shared with me was a version of this thing, and I, as you can imagine, was instantaneously obsessed with this idea of these... men who were like their peers in every way, except they would dress up as the angel and go out at night and comfort the dying and encourage them to die bravely and not to accelerate their dying in any way. Right. Yeah.
Wow. I sort of was hoping you were going to tell me you just made it up.
Speak. I'm sorry. Well, so again, like but I have assiduously.
It could. We're not sure, but the
it
fact
lives
that
in the it lives is, in the Schrodinger's Valley. I mean, again, like I can't If such a man existed, he's certainly not going to go on American news and talk about it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. And Iran isn't going to say that they had a man do it. Right. And there's no way to prove that such a man didn't exist.
Right.
You know? And so it just sort of lives in this Schrodinger's valley of possibility.
Okay. As I mentioned, I was on your IG stalking you. And on one of your posts of, I think maybe when you got the arcs of these books, you said something along the lines of like, this book isn't by you or of you, but that it is you. And I'm curious, what do you mean by that?
I mean, I told my spouse this when we got the final copies of the book too. They were holding it and they were sort of like, how do you feel? And I really do. I mean, it's going to sound like I'm joking, but I really do feel like with the AI that we have right now, today, like if you just fed this book to that AI and then like put that into like a talking mannequin or whatever, like it could be like 85% of hanging out with me. You know what I mean? Like my spouse, like if I ever die or whatever, like my spouse can just feed this book into an AI mannequin and like just kick it with me. I mean, I don't know that they would necessarily want to do that.
Yeah.
Right? But it feels like, you know, like what your thumbprint is to your hand. Like this is like a brain print. You know what I mean? Like
right.
It just it, like, and it's such an uncanny way of talking about it. You know, I am in recovery. And I'm a sober person. I've been in recovery for a decade. And, in my particular vein of recovery, they mark significant intervals of sobriety with chips.
Yeah.
And I remember holding my 1 year chip when I got it. And that feeling is almost like indistinguishable from holding the finished final copy of my book, right? It's just like, it's not this like creative epic of my like E-P-O-C-H, E-P-I-C. is that pronounced epic? Epoch? I don't know. Whatever.
Listen, I don't know. BIPOC? Who knows? It's hard to know for
sure. There's so many words that I know on the page that I never have occasion to say. But it's not this creative pinnacle. I mean, it is a creative pinnacle. It is the creative pinnacle of my life. But it really feels like the sort of like psycho-spiritual culmination of like every meeting that I've ever sat in and every, you know, every newcomer that I've ever helped and every, you know, every prayer that I've ever prayed. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like the culmination of my sort of psycho-spiritual self more than it does a culmination of my creative self, which again, I know it sounds like so sort of woo-woo and pie in the sky and sort of pinky in the air and like I'm flattering myself, but I can't.
Right.
And that's, I think that was like the sentiment of the Instagram that sounds like corny or whatever, but like it really, I can't say it any other way. Like that's what it feels like to me. It's just like, here is my heart. Maybe it'll fit in your chest, you know?
Yeah. I feel like some of the marketing copy that I got on this book, which I never read, but sometimes I'll go back afterwards. I hate it.
Yeah, I do the same. I do the exact same thing.
Because it's like, it's a lie. It's such a lie that it will fuck up my entire reading experience.
Yeah.
And with this one, I knew I was going to read it because of Clint. So I was like, well, I don't, like when they sent it over, I was like, yeah, just send the book. Sounds great. But I never really ask novelists about this, but it's only because they put it in there. They call this an autobiographical novel. But do
in
you
the,
feel
in the
like
marketing
it is
copy
one?
They call it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that they did that. I didn't know that they did that.
Is it
I mean, I believe you. Listen, I believe you.
I mean, saw that. And I was like, I read it after I read the book. And I was like, well, do you feel that it's that?
I mean, I've spoken about this with other people at Knopf, too. Is like, I feel like I relate to Orchida, the artist, or the Arash, the uncle, as much as I do Cyrus. You know, there are certainly superficial details of Cyrus's in my life that have symmetries. You know, I'm an Iranian American poet in recovery. But so are there symmetries with Arash and Orchida and Ali, his father, you know. And so it's autobiographical in that, of course, it's all emanating from my singular, unprecedented consciousness. And everything that I do in language passes through the filter of my experience, but I didn't set out to have Cyrus be an avatar for me or have some hidden set of symbols or shibboleths that would reveal something autobiographical to the world about myself.
I didn't get that sense, but I was like, I gotta ask him because I didn't get that sense, but like maybe I just didn't, I couldn't find anything about you online. I don't know.
And that's no shade to auto. I mean, like some of my favorite writers do brilliant auto fiction.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what this is.
Okay. That's not what I thought either. Okay. Speaking of real life things that are in this book, there is a plane crash that is, this is not a spoiler, very early on. And it is a real plane crash that happened in 1988. The United States accidentally murdered hundreds of people by shooting down an Iranian plane. Flight 655?
Yeah.
655?
Flight 655. Iran Air Flight 655.
And I wanted to know why you wanted to talk about that in the book. And also, and this is like really small, you talk about the meals that were served and what was in the flight catalog. Did you actually look that up and find?
I did.
Okay. Okay, it was so specific that I was like, either this guy is crazy and just made up the most specific details ever, or he researched the shit out of this.
Yeah.
Okay, so you researched it. But why did you want to talk about this flight?
Yeah, so in 1988, a U.S. naval airship shot a civilian Iranian airliner out of the sky over the Persian Gulf, and 290 people on board were murdered, including 66 women and children, and nobody knows about it. You know, nobody in America knows about it. In Iran, they literally put it on postage stamps. Like, I have an Iranian postage stamp, like commemorating this disaster or honoring or memorializing this disaster, right? The same way that, you know, we have 9/11 on postage stamps. Yeah, exactly. And if it were the other way around, like, imagine if Iran shot a U.S. airplane, you know, Iran would have been
turned
to glass. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like the imprecision of American justice is a given, right? Like, the naval airship said they thought it was a military plane and it was flying too close to them. And, you know, the there's nothing about its behavior or its, you know, communications that said it was a, you know, it was a civilian airliner flying on a civilian air path, right? And that number, 290, I'm thinking about the same thing now in Gaza and in Sudan and in Congo and in Ukraine, right? Like, we see these numbers every day, and 290 people killed on this flight. If it was 291 or if it was 289, my brain wouldn't really be able to register the difference. You know, like, they're both sort of like middle large numbers. It's more than five, but it's less than 50,000, right? You know, like, but that difference, that one person's difference, is this entire book, right? These generations and generations of people, and also, like, associates of those people. You know, Z is a character in this book whose life is indelibly inflected by this one person's death on that flight,
right?
And I wanted to give the texture of individual narrative to a collective grief, right? And I, you know, because that's what fiction can do. Because if you see that one of those 290 lives is felt this deeply across this many generations by people so far removed from that one person, like Zbigniew Ramadan Novak, this Polish-Egyptian immigrant who has nothing to do with Iran, you know, but his life is indelibly impacted by this death that happened 30 years before his birth, or 30 years before the actions of the novel. You see that one life, and now extrapolate that outwards, 290 times, or however many times, you know, and that is the sort of political exercise that I'm really, really interested in, and for myself, like, I struggle to make meaning of these abstract numbers, but when they are lent the texture of individual narrative, it clarifies the magnitude, If the only thing a person walks, if someone's like, I hate this book, but now I will always remember that in 1988, a U.S. naval airship shot Iran Air Flight 655 out of the sky, then that's a rousing success for me.
Wow. I'm going to do just like an insanely hard shift.
Sure. Yeah.
You said you don't know the difference between epic and epoch. Pronunciation. I think I did it right. I don't know. What about a word that you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh my God. Restaurant. I always forget
God,
where
you're in the restaurant club.
Yeah. Oh, is that a club?
It is the most elite club. Jason Reynolds, Angelina Jolie.
Wow.
Quentin Tarantino.
Wow.
And then others that I can never remember. Sure. But like many people are in that club. It is probably the most said word. And for I'm a person who cannot spell, like a truly horrific speller. I can spell restaurant. No fucking problem.
Amazing.
Restaurant is like the only word I can spell.
Yeah, I can never remember where the AU goes.
Yeah.
I know that an AU exists in it, but who knows? And like bureaucracy is another one.
There's that just I like could never do that.
Just like a puke pile of vowels somewhere in there. And it's just like pure luck if you get it right.
Yeah, if you get it right. That's so true. Yeah. I'm just a little bit curious about what things that you were reading or watching when you were preparing for this, as you mentioned, that like stick out to you as having been particularly formative or like helpful.
Yeah. Tommy Orange Is There is huge, huge, huge for me, both biographically, like in terms of my life, bringing me in touch with Tommy, who's now one of my best friends, but also just creatively, aesthetically in tricking you by creating such a delicious narrative that you don't even notice that he'll go two or three pages of just thoughts about the world.
Yeah.
You know, like he'll just be like, here's what I think about art, or here's what I think about death, or here's what I, you know, and it'll just be like a little essay, a little treatise on dying. Right. But because it's in this narrative package, you don't even notice he's doing it. Right. And that, I mean, this whole book is basically just cribbing him in that respect, right? Mm. Is like it becomes this incredible way to just figure out what I think about stuff, and then take antagonistic positions from what I think, just to sort of ventriloquize them and make the sock puppets argue with each other, right? So that is a huge influence on me. There's also this book by Nicholson Baker, who is a big person for me. He's this incredible writer of ferocious, granular observation, you know, like the eccentricity of the way that he looks at things is so specific and delicious.
I love
that. And he had this book called Checkpoint that I read in high school. And the whole book, I think it was published in 2004, 2005, thereabouts. And so it was right after 9/11, right after we went to war with Iraq, right? Despite Iraq having nothing to do with that, you know.
Nailed it.
And and the whole book, all of Checkpoint, is just an ethical conversation sat in a room with this guy who is deliberating whether or not to assassinate George W. Bush. And, you know, and the ethics of assassinating George W. Bush, he's like, I mean, he's killing a lot of people over
there.
I would just be killing him and myself. So, like, is that an ethical good thing? You know?
Right.
And that, I mean, I read this, like, when it came out, so... You know, I was probably, I don't know, 14, 15.
Got it.
But I remember it feeling so radical to me. Mm-hmm. I remember it feeling like the Anarchist Cookbook or something. Like I needed to hide it under my mattress, you know, because I was this Iranian Muslim kid who had this book about assassinating George W. Bush. And I read it and reread it. And I was like, oh my God, you're allowed to say, you're allowed to admit that you're thinking about the ethics of something like that, you know? And, and again, I mean, I didn't start Martyr until 15 years later, right? Start working on Martyr in earnest, and it's not going to come out until 20 or I don't know the math, whatever. But you know, it's a long time between these events, but I think about that planting the seed of like, you know, I mean, this book, I think there's a part in this book where Cyrus talks about the ethics of, kidnapping a conservative Supreme Court justice or something like that, right? And it's like, I mean, I don't know. Like, it feels like the net bad would be worth it. Yeah. And the idea that I'm allowed to write that sentence in a book is utterly radical, still feeling to my mind. You know, I talk to my students a lot about risk, you know, and I think that, you know, there's a place for the kind of risk that says, you know, what drugs you snorted off of what surface or what sex acts you committed in what place, right? But there's also the kind of risk that's just like saying the really scary thing when you're, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The thing that could actually get you in trouble, the thing that could actually have people, you know, June Jordan has a poem where the first line is, what if every time they killed a black boy, we killed a cop? Right. And she would read that in front of groups of, you know, and this is decades ago, you know, before, you know, even saying it now on a podcast was a little like, you know, but that feels like risk to me. You know what I mean? That feels like you're actually advancing something that could be taken away from you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I'm interested in artists like that who are really sort of putting something on the line.
Yeah. I love that. I told you at the beginning, I don't even know if I said this on air, but I might have said it before, that I was going to ask you a personal question that wasn't that personal, please, but was exciting to me. And we don't have that much time. Yeah. So I have two questions. One of them is, you are a poet in community with some of this show's favorite poets. You are friends with Hanif and Clint. And in the book...
They're both in the same group chat, actually.
Oh my God, I want to be in the chat. Hello. way to make me feel left out.
I guess the first rule of the group chat is you don't acknowledge.
Don't tell who's in the group chat.
So, yeah, sorry.
Anyways, I have my own group chats. Don't worry, you'll be jealous too. but in the book, basketball comes up a lot.
Yeah.
And I know some other poets who are also really into sports. Are you a basketball guy? And who
I'm
is your team?
Guy.
The Pacers?
No, I'm actually a Milwaukee Bucks guy. I've been a Bucks fan since like the, around a lot.
So now it's a good time to be a Bucks fan, but.
Yeah, but it's the first, I mean, I grew up watching like the Sam Cassell, Ray Allen, Glenn Robbins, even the Vin Baker Bucks before that.
I'm a Warriors fan.
It's a funny time to be a Warriors fan.
Well, now it's gotten really interesting, but
it's
used to be like hell. And then it was like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Yeah,
and now
you're at the tail end of a really incredible. I mean, this is like a life-defining run. I mean, we're sort of in a similar boat where like Giannis is the best player who will ever play for my favorite team in my lifetime.
Yes,
you know what I mean? Like, there's no one. You know, there's never going to be a Warrior who's drafted by the Warriors who's going to be a more important player than Steph Curry. You know what I mean? Like, we're living in the peaks
the
of
moment.
Our franchises right now, right? So I'm trying to like absorb it all and take it all in. You know, like Clint actually took me to. He was speaking. This was the last like public thing that I did before the quarantine. But it was that Bucks season. He took me to, he was speaking to the team for,
cool.
I know. This is what I'm saying. He's the worst. He's like, it's like, I'll be like, you know, I'll be like, you know, like this place said something about my book. And he's like, cool. I was hanging out with Giannis today. Yeah. actually, literally the other day, I was talking about American Fiction and like how excited I was to see it. This was a couple of weeks ago. And he was like, oh yeah, cool. No, I just did this.
With Jeffrey Wright.
I just did this event with the star of the film.
Yeah.
Right?
I fucking saw that.
But it was literally like, I was talking about it like that. And then he sent me the picture.
By the way.
Yeah. But he took me to a Kings Bucks game. And because he was the guest, we got to sit like literally like feet on the hardwood.
Oh my gosh.
And it was like the coolest experience. I mean, I've been to a lot of Bucks games now, but never like where,
like
you know, Chris Middleton is like two
right
feet in front
there.
Of me. You know
right
what I mean?
There. Yeah. It's a tough time to be a Warriors fan for sure. But I just love that there's like this poet basketball contingency. And I'm like, I found my people. Because I'm not into poetry, but I am into basketball. And I'm like, okay,
there's something
to talk to you all about.
Like Vivian Lee is a really, really wonderful editor for Little Brown, who's also like in our, you know, and she's a huge Clippers fan.
Vivian Lee is also the lead actress in my favorite film, Gone with the Wind. So don't get me excited by saying Vivian Lee and then tell me about
an
editor.
I didn't even think about that. I'm sure that she's got, I've never even made that connection. Hers is L.I., but Nabila Lovelace is a really, really wonderful poet who's also like a basketball stan. Joy Priest is a wonderful poet.
Okay. So there are
Natalie Diaz, everyone knows. How are you feeling about Draymond right now?
You know, I have a lot of really complicated feelings about it because I'm having a lot of issues. I really hate Adam Silver. I think he's a terrible commissioner and I think he's like a spineless human. And the whole punishment of this whole thing and like the arbitrariness between the Ja Morant and the Draymond thing. Oh my God. I like wanted to cry last night
when he
should sue them and be like, you guys fucking owe me for those 25 fucking games. And for my body for being like weaker because I haven't been playing. And then I come back out and I give you like 8 incredible games and then I get hurt all off some shit that I did that was fully legal on my social media outside of work.
Well, and the hilarious thing is, like, if he was like an NFL player being like, look at my gun closet, here are 27 AK-47s or some shit, you know.
Well, I think I think he would have had to be a white player. I think the whole point 100%. Is that he's black player. Yeah, you know, like if he was like a black quarterback, it wouldn't have been any different. Yeah. But the whole like Ja Morant punishment and then trying to justify whatever they do to anyone else based off the arbitrariness of that has made this whole Draymond thing really frustrating for me, because I'm like, if you want to punish him for something that he did during his work job that is against the rules of the job, which I understand,
of the work job,
it's against the rules. So I get that. Like, you super shouldn't do things. But if that is something that he's done, then you, as the institution that is punishing him, you should have some guidelines about what you're going to do. The indefinite suspension, if it's a thing, like, do you know what I mean? It's like, in your little handbook. Hey, if you keep hitting people or choking out players that everyone hates and nobody wants to defend or whatever, like, then you're going to get 10 games or you're going to get 15 games.
Yeah. But saying it's like first offense is like a fine. Yes. Second offense is one game.
Yes.
There should be
rules. Because now I'm like, okay, well, is what Draymond did actually less bad than what Ja Morant did?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm having all of those feelings.
No, I feel exactly the same. I've always loved, like, I love those sort of undersized players who are just like all over the court, like diving after every. So I've loved
Draymond.
Since he came into the league.
My favorite kind of athlete is the villain. I love a villain. Like, Steph Curry because he's great, but I'm like, he's fine.
Like, Steph Curry is like the rich man's Russell Wilson in terms of just being
who
like,
is my
like,
least just, favorite black athlete.
That sort of like everyone likes me and I'm kind of neutral about, you know, like Steph Curry actually has thoughts and ideas.
Yes. And Steph advances. Curry is a little, can be like a little chesty sometimes.
When the games matter. When the games matter, Steph Curry gets more than a little chesty, which I love. I mean, like I say this, you know, like I love that competitive streak when he lets it out. But he's also like very, clean. He's a sweet guy. Like you understand that constitutionally, like he would have your back, you know. But I too, like Montrezl Harrell was one of my favorite players ever. And now he's like basically out of the league for the same sort of vibe, you know, like he was just like he's like a little undersized, but diving after every loose ball and, you know, all this.
Okay, last question. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read Martyr, who would you want it to be?
Oh, my God. Wow, I was not ready for that. Just in the interest of me not hemming and hawing forever, I'll say Borges. I love Borges so much. He's like one of my Mount Rushmore guys. Okay. And just to be able to say that Borges spent time with a thing that I made. I don't think he'd like it, you know, whatever. Yeah.
This is about you. It's not about him.
Yeah. I just, to be able to know in my marrow that Borges engaged with a piece of art that I made would be incredible. If you ask me this question again in an hour, I'll have a different answer. I didn't think about this.
No, I'm glad that you didn't. We got an authentic, unprepared answer.
Yeah. But I think it would be cool.
Everyone, that's it for us today. Martyr by Kaveh Akbar. You can get it wherever you get your books. I read the book, but I am told the audiobook is fucking fantastic. A friend of mine, Rosman from the Stacks Pack, read it, loved it, said it was so well done. So if you're an audiobook person, I will give it my official, unofficial stamp of approval because I haven't listened. But the book is so good. I can't imagine it wouldn't be great. You can get it. The book is out now as you're listening to this. It came out yesterday as you're listening to this. So go get it. Let's get this book on all the lists and everything. I have no doubt we will be talking about it all year long. So thank you so much, Kaveh.
Thank you so much, Tracy. This was so much fun.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to Kaveh Akbar for joining the show. I'd also like to say a special thank you to Josie Cals for helping to make this conversation possible. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for January is Erasure by Percival Everett. And we will be discussing that book on January 31st with our guest, Zach Stafford. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com.
This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.